My name is Zephyr, and this is Frank Prattle. You're listening to Neighborhood Public Radio, 88.9 FM. I'm here today with Kitty Scott, Chief Curator of Serpentine Gallery in London. Hi,
hi.
Kitty.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. Good.
So I wanted to ask you a few questions today. Nothing crazy intensive, but we'll see where we go. First of all, this interview is happening in San Francisco. What brings you to San Francisco?
I've been teaching for, this is the fourth year, I've been teaching at the California College of the Arts. I teach MA students who are in the curating course at the California College of the Arts. I teach them how to acquire art for institutions. So we have it takes place over about 7 days where we do this kind of workshop about exactly how institutions acquire art. And it's a kind of lengthy, in-depth process in real institutions. It can take anywhere between 6 months and 3 years, but we condense it into a kind of quick course, and they learn the basics of doing that. They love it, and I love it.
So, awesome. Yeah. And so you yourself, you've bought for institutions before.
Yeah, I worked at the National Gallery of Canada before I went to the Serpentine. The Serpentine doesn't collect work, but the National Gallery of Canada is a collecting institution, and when I was there, I was responsible for the whole contemporary department, which I had, you know, about five staff directly under me, three curators, I guess, and I had to buy for the whole country, and I was responsible for art of the last 25 years, Canada-wide, but also internationally, worldwide and Canada-wide, and, you know, one of the things is I guess I studied curating, like the students are studying here. I studied curating for 2 years at the Royal College of Art in London. And shortly after doing that, I met Kate for the first time, Kate Fowle, who's the director of the program here. And she said, you know, if you were setting up a course, you know, was there something that you needed to, that you should have been taught that you weren't taught, or something you think curatorial programs are missing? And I said, well, you know, I've come into this job at the National Gallery of Canada where I'm acquiring art. And while I believe I have the skills to do that, I know how to do that. Nobody ever taught me how to do that or how that's done. And in a sense, the process, as I saw, the very first time I witnessed the process at the National Gallery of Canada, I thought it was some kind of wild theater. Like, I'd never seen anything like that in my life before. And I thought, oh my God, this is incredible. You know, I just never seen the process. And it is that particular moment where I sort of first witnessed it at the National Gallery was a particular dramatic moment, because there was a work of art that was going to leave the country if we didn't buy it, or if something like that, if the government didn't come in and buy it. There are all these funny tax laws in Canada, so works of art have to be looked at by sort of larger bodies. And this was a very early work by an artist, I think his name, somebody Peel, I believe. I can't remember his first name, but he painted very early images of North American Indians. And so it was an image of some famous chief. It was probably a painting that was about 200 years old, which in Canada is old, you know, or 150 years old or something. And kind of everyone had to rush into this room. And I'd never been to the room in the gallery before where acquired works sort of sit. And it was very beautifully lit. I think North Light, again, I'm really bad with directions, but North Light coming in, and you know, six sort of people, maybe 12 people sort of standing in front of this thing. The curator, who's, you know, passionate about the work, was giving this very dramatic kind of speech about why it was important and things. And you're kind of thinking, well, you know, it's like this kind of moment where culture matters within the institution, and where you're actually really focused on art and nothing else. It is the object that's in front of you. It's, you know, you're there with the person who probably knows most in the world about it, talking about it, and he's got some other works from the collection that are by the same artist, so you get to see a context for the work as well. And then a kind of discussion ensues as to why this is important, but, you know, everybody's well-dressed because it's a special meeting at the gallery. Do you know what I mean? It's very, whether I'm telling you the truth or not, something like that's impressed on my mind. You know, it's like 6 years ago now, and I really didn't understand what was going on. And but, you know, since that time, I've been in the position of that particular curator, having to you know, defend works of art that I want for the collection very vocally, very strongly, firmly. And, you know, do it in front of my peers, because it is a kind of performance. You have to justify it, not only on paper in a text, but also verbally in front of your peers. And you have to say why this is important, you know, to the collection, why this is important within the context of art in the country, and, you know, why it should be in the gallery, why tax dollars should be spent on this work of art. And so it's for me, it was like maybe the most important thing I did at the gallery, of all the things that I did, is the most important thing, the most exciting, the most difficult. But also the thing I was never taught about, you know. Right. So I told that to Kate anyway, and she invited me to come and teach acquisition here at the California College of the Arts. So I had to invent. I was invited, Kate then invited me to teach this, and I had to figure out a way, how would you actually teach this? I'd never been taught it, so I had to think about how might that be done. And I sat down and thought about it and came up with some ideas and sort of ran them around, or traded the ideas with friends and things and talked to them, and came up with this idea that, over a course of maybe 3 classes, the very first class, you would look at the students and you would decide that they were going to be chief curators or curators of contemporary art at major institutions. So, I appoint one of them as curator of contemporary art at the Pompidou in Paris, one at SF MoMA, one at the National Gallery in Canada, one at MoMA in New York, all the major institutions. And the reason we work with major institutions in the class is because most of them have their, maybe not complete collections, but a lot of their collections on the internet, on the web. So you go to the gallery's website, you can see what they own. Well, I know that most of them aren't complete. It does give the students a sense of what's in the collection. And anyway, so they're appointed to these museums, and then they have to run away, and they have to think about works that would make sense in these museums, significant works, major works. Each student comes back to me with four works, and then we, as a class and as a kind of acquisition committee, I sort of pretend to be the director, and they're kind of my colleagues. Each student comes up with four works, and we decide yes, yes, no, no. And so they go forward with 2 of them. Sometimes if the 4 that they bring aren't good enough, I'll pump them up a bit and, make them do something and do a little bit more work so we get some good works. And then they have to run away and write the justifications. So the next class is really about actually the whole, how you write a justification, what needs to be there, what's important. When you're buying a work of art, for example, you want to know that the artist has, educated in some way, has had some exhibitions, has built up some credibility, has perhaps had major articles written on them so that there's people who've been interested, there's a critical body around them. And then from there, you want to look at, maybe the area the artist has been working in, so what is their kind of field of study? What is the area? Are they making sculpture? If they're making sculpture, where does the sculpture come from? What are its sources? What was the context for this kind of work? And then, from there, you're going to look at the individual work you're buying. So is this a highly representative work? Is this the most important work the artist has ever made? Is this a kind of curiosity that will be useful? Maybe you already have 30 works by this artist in the collection, but this kind of funny thing has come along that's kind of a curiosity in the artist's oeuvre, but you feel that that's something that should be in the collection, so you're going to buy it. So you kind of have a look at the actual object, and you write about it in a way that kind of reveals it or explores it, investigates it, brings it to the surface more. And then probably you'll sort of tie up with a paragraph about why the work of art is particularly important for this collection at this moment now. Right. And that's kind of the end. So we're going to go through that process with them in the second class. And then also talking about the, you have to justify, I talked to you about the sort of theater of the acquisition. So to, you have to come in on the day of the acquisition, you have to be well dressed, and you have to kind of stand in front of that object, and you have to be willing to defend it verbally. And of course, you're not going to read out your justification. That's more academic. A more academic text, but you want to stand up and you want to say who the artist is, introduce that to your peers, again, roughly the medium, everything about the artwork itself, then who the artist is, and then why is this particular work important, and then why is this work important to the collection. And, in the course of an acquisitions meeting, we had 20 curators, roughly 20 curators at my museum. Each of them might be acquiring 200 pieces. It really depends on what each curator's up to, but you can have maybe 400 works go through in a day. And when you do have a volume that's that big, usually there might be a series of photographs that's being donated that's 100 photographs or something. But, you usually have maybe 8 or 9 objects or 8 or 9 separate things, which, one of them might have 200 components. But they're very intense, long meetings. And, kind of give them a feeling of what that's like. And then the very last class, they have to stand up. They have their work of art, on a kind of PowerPoint presentation. And they discuss why they do the whole thing, and they get through it. And the class itself forms the acquisition committee. So, they might say, "Well, I don't think this is really important work, or this work isn't." Sometimes they turn down the works. So I let them kind of vote, and I let them decide, and let them kind of discuss, and really force them to be critical of these acquisitions as well, because that's the other thing. As an acquisition committee, you have a responsibility, again, to, in Canada, and it's different here in the United States, but in Canada, particularly to the taxpayer, the fact that these dollars are being spent, but you have a responsibility also as you know, at the National Gallery of Canada, for example, you want the collection to be the best possible collection in the country and one of the best possible collections in the world. And so you're always thinking, is this really a key thing for us to have now? Why is this important? And you know what I mean? So, you know, you want the acquisition committee to be critical and to be, well, either for you or against you. And, you know, hopefully the reasons they're for you are good reasons, as the reasons they're against you are ones about responsibility and things like that. So it's really fun to do, and you see kind of a transformation in the students. They're completely terrified, of course, in the beginning, and they kind of can't believe what they have to do. But at the end of it, once they do it and they understand how the whole mechanism works, they, you know, you kind of see a confidence in them. Some of them kind of come alive like they're stars, you know. They kind of take the floor and they do their thing. And there was one particular student yesterday who, you know, I think he went on for about 40 minutes, and the allotted time is 15. but he generated a lot of discussion, and people were truly kind of excited and kind of terrified by the prospect of acquiring this work. And so they really, you know, got into quite a deep discussion. It was for, you know, as a teacher or as somebody who wants to see people learn, it's really encouraging to watch that, and it's really, you know, that you've done something right when that's happening, you know, and it's really kind of a pleasure to watch. But, you know, I learn a lot from them, and, you know, sometimes they come up with new techniques and things that I haven't seen before. I love doing it. I'm really passionate about it, so I feel privileged to be here. That's why I'm here.
So you'd spoken some about your time in Canada at the National Gallery there, and then you made a switch to Serpentine Gallery in London. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the switch there, and maybe what you do now for Serpentine.
What I do now, yeah. Okay, at the National Gallery, I told you I was responsible for a collection. I worked in a very large institution with 20 other curators. I had about 2,500 works in my collection, maybe a bit more. I managed a group of people. I was in this big institution managing a collection in a small town. I guess Ottawa is the capital of Canada, but it's maybe 800,000. But really, it's kind of a village with suburbs around it. And I guess, you know, I'd been there for 6 years. I learned a huge amount when I was there. I learned a huge amount, but I had never imagined myself in an institution like that. And I think, in a way, for me, the kind of ideal world was a kind of space that primarily focused on contemporary and primarily focused on exhibitions and was kind of fast moving. That was more what I've always been interested in, and I'd never really been interested in collecting art. I mean, I did it, and, you know, I enjoyed doing it, and I did it to the best of my ability, but it'd never been the kind of thing that I was I deeply wanted to do. And so after 6 years, I thought, well, this is great. You know, I've learned a huge amount. I've loved doing this. But it's time for me to try something else. And I went to school in London. I studied there at the Royal College of Art. And London, it was always a city. I taught there as well after I finished school. It's always a city that I've really loved. And I have a lot of friends there. And I guess the possibility came up to work there, particularly at the Serpentine, which is an institution devoted to contemporary art. And they do 5 exhibitions a year. Do you know the Serpentine at all? It's located in Kensington Gardens, beautiful park setting. It's across the street from where I went to school, so I knew the neighborhood. it's got a great reputation. I guess that was finally, in a sense, I wanted to be closer to what I would call something like the making of culture at the museum. And you know, while I tried to buy work by very young artists and emerging artists and to keep the collection really fresh and to reinvigorate the collection, I always felt in a way like I was receiving, and I was sort of at a little bit of a distance from what was happening in the art world. And in a sense, Ottawa is not known as an art center. You know, I would travel to New York or travel to London or you know, wherever, and you know, I felt I was sort of in the thick of things, but I wanted to be more in a kind of central location, and I wanted to be closer to art production in a way. And so that was part of the motive, you know, for going there. Also, you know, I don't know how much you know about the Serpentine, but they have 2 directors. So Julia Payton-Jones is one of the directors, along with Hans-Ulrich Obrist, and they're both people who are highly competent, completely exciting. they're great models, you know, like the fact that they even wanted to work with me. It's like, okay, I'm happy to come and work with you and to kind of make this thing go and make this ship, you know, float through the ocean in the best possible way or move through the universe wherever it's going to go. I know they're really exciting, and I wanted to have different models. The museum encourages a kind of and this is a kind of gross generalization, but the museum encourages, or the kind of museum I was in encourages a kind of administrative, it has a kind of administrative sadness about it, and it's slow, it's very slow, and as much as I wanted things to be quicker and fast, we could never do that because we were a museum. Whereas the Serpentine is just, it's a quite a flexible institution, it's small, things change very quickly, so what you think you might be doing for 10 minutes changes, and you know, you're going in another direction in the next 10 minutes, then you're going back, and you're going back in the same direction, then you know what I mean? It's a flexible, small institution, and it works at a very high level, it's highly ambitious, and I have to say, I've been there for 3 months, and it's been really, really hard, but, you know, completely exciting, and kind of really, really enjoyed the work I've been doing. It's of a very different nature, but work I know how to do.
Yeah.
You know? And everyone at the Serpentine, it's an amazing staff. They're all completely devoted to the institution. They all work very hard, and they all want to see the same results, whatever those results are that we want to achieve. They want to see them. So it's exciting.
And you just had a show of Damien Hirst's.
Yeah, we just opened a show. I guess just before I left on Friday, of Damien Hirst's collection. So it's not his own work, it's his collection. And it's remarkable in the sense that Damien Hirst has amassed, I think, over 1,000 objects in his personal collection. At the Serpentine, he's showing 66 of those things. So really, like any museum collection, any collection in the world, you're only seeing a small portion of it. I think he's been very, very generous of him to lend it to the Serpentine and to do this. He actually curated the show, so he's responsible for, you know, the title, the placement of works, the selection of works. He's done every single thing. And I guess if you sit and think about it, it's really distinctive because of that. When was the last time you saw a show of an artist's own collection? Okay, you might say, okay, well, I went to the so-and-so Noguchi Museum, or I went here. You know, you have artists who have died, and sometimes museums will show portions of their collection, or, like, you know, artist-dedicated museums will have works that the artists have collected, but you rarely see an artist, a living artist, who's created his own collection, and that collection's on display. What's also remarkable about that collection is that he's really got major and exceptional works of art in it. So he has, you know, Jeff Koons vacuum cleaner pieces from the 1980s. He has, you know, recent Jeff Koons piece from 2005 called Moon, which, you know, for me is the star of the show. It's a massive sort of pillow-like piece that sits on the wall. It must be over a meter wide and a meter high. It's more than that. It might be 2 meters wide, 2 meters high, maybe three, or 3 meters in diameter. And it reflects everything in the room. And, you know, it actually doesn't fit into any of the doors of the Serpentine. It's like, you know, if anyone sits and thinks about it, they're going to try and figure out how we got that into the building. And I'm not going to tell you how we did that now, but it was a very complicated work to get in the building. He also owns...
Can I guess?
I know. No. He owns a work by Francis Bacon from, I think, 42, 43, a painting by Francis Bacon. He has a lot of Richard Prince works, so Big Joke paintings, Major Richard Prince works. You know, in a sense, I guess the way the show is constructed is you have these kinds of figures that would be, say, kind of father figures or you know, artists that have been highly influential, first practice artists that have been fans of, but kind of an older generation. So they're not the same generation, but in the context of the show, they're an older generation. So people like Bacon, he's got Warhol, so he has a really nice Jackie Onassis painting and a car crash painting. And an electric chair painting, three Warhols, Richard Prince, Chaim Steinbach, and Jeff Koons. So those are the kind of older figures in the show. Then what you have are peers. So he apparently has the largest collection of Sarah Lucas works, and there are quite a few pieces by Sarah Lucas in the show. Angus Fairhurst, I'm just trying to think other Marcus. I'm sorry, I forget Marcus's last name. Marcus Harvey, I think.
Harvey.
Yeah, by Marcus Harvey, Tracy Eamon, Angela Bullock. So those are kind of artists that would be more peers. And then there are sort of a group of younger artists who he's been acquiring by people like, I don't know, Tim Lewis, Ian Lum, I think Tom Ormond, painter. So it's just really interesting that, you know, he's also going in there and he's acquiring work by younger artists as well. And, you know, he's brought them all together. He's done, I think, a pretty strong installation. There's also work, sculptural works out on the lawn. I think it's about five different sculpture works, one by Sarah Lucas, one by Angus Fairhurst, Sean Launders, Don Brown, another younger artist. So, you know, it's pretty exceptional. If you can think of another case where you can think of an artist who's inhabited a museum or gallery space with his own collection curated and assembled all, he's in a, again, you know, I think he's a kind of, he is a figure who is representative of vast changes that have happened in the art world. I mean, artists can become successful financially, but it doesn't happen to very many of them. And, you know, the fact that he's then sort of taken his money, invested it in contemporary art, and, you know, is putting it on display in public is just exceptional. He's bought he's bought this manor house in England, Toddington Manor, and it's a 300-room mansion. He's going to be opening that to the public. So I think, in a way, you know, what he's done at the Serpentine is a kind of he's sort of rehearsing. You know, it's almost like
it's a
prototype.
Preview, yeah.
Yeah. These are the kinds of things I've been collecting. And you know, when Toddington Manor opens, these are the kinds of things.
So, as far as projects that you have coming up at Serpentine, what are you working on?
Well, you know, the way the Serpentine works, we work on everything together. When I arrived, we were doing a show, which was something that Hans Ulrich had worked on with Daniel Birnbaum and the curator, the director from the Astrup Firmly Museum. Can't do his name right now, I'm sorry. So it was Hans Ulrich, Daniel Birnbaum, and the director of the Astrup Firmly Museum. They did a show called The Uncertain States of America, and they exhibited the work of 45 artists. I came to the gallery when that was happening, and, you know, it's a small institution. I can't say this is my project, I'm not working.
Right.
Just kind of jump in. We also did a show. One of the things the Serpentine Gallery is doing, it's a tea house from 1932, 1937, in Kensington Gardens. It's a historic building, a heritage building. The footprint of the building can never change. You can't expand this building. But what's happened is the ambitions of the directors are they want to go, okay, we'll expand the program and we'll be the Serpentine in different locations. So shortly after I came, they took over Battersea Power Station,
right,
and they did a show of 52 Chinese artists. It was a show called China Power Station Part 1, and it's a show that will travel to Beijing and to Oslo, and kind of it'll actually show up in Beijing for the Olympics in 2008 and accrue and change as it kind of moves forward. So you know, that was going on. I can't say, oh, I'm not going to work on that, it's not my show. So you could just kind of jump in. And in a sense, you know, the program that's coming up is something that I'm working on them with and collaborating on them with. So the next show after Damien Hirst will be Karen Kalimnik, American Philadelphia-based painter. And then after Karen, it's Paul Chen, who lives in New York. Paul Chen lives in New York, does video projection works, video animation works, young artist, political activist. It's exciting work. Like, it's in a sense, it's much closer to the kind of thing I have always wanted to be doing. You know, the National Gallery, I was able to be close to new work and new production, and then I tried to buy it. But this is we're going to put it on exhibit and show it to the rest of the world, you know.
Right.
And that's really all I can talk about in terms of the program right now. I mean, I guess we're also planning, like we did the China show, we're planning on doing a show about India that'll be off-site, and that's a big project that's going on. But no, it's an incredibly ambitious institution for its scale, and the projects are kind of exciting, dynamic. What's also, for me, coming from Canada, kind of interesting is that the National Gallery of Canada, in terms of the people that come through the institution per year, it's about 500,000 people. And they're not necessarily coming to see contemporary art. They might be coming to see our major exhibit. I think I sort of mentioned this, we have 20 curators, so we have, you know, Renaissance paintings, we have Asian art, we have all kinds of different things going on in the museum. The Serpentine is focused on contemporary, but last year our attendance figures were something like 750,000 over the course of a year, so No, so I mean, something else that's sort of interesting for me at the Serpentine is, you know, it's an institution that focuses completely on contemporary art, whereas the National Gallery was a more diverse institution. You had, you know, temporary exhibitions, you had the collections. There were 20 curators, each with their own kind of, you know, collecting area, so diverse collection. People coming to the institution are not necessarily coming for contemporary art, and in fact, I think we did studies that showed they weren't really coming for contemporary art. So, you know, you don't have a huge audience in a city of 800,000, even though there's a tourist population and things. But at the Serpentine, you're there in the park in this beautiful location. Your focus is pretty much contemporary art. I mean, we do some modern, what I would call modern art programming, but contemporary art. And of course, we have architecture. We have the pavilions that we do. But we have about 750,000 people coming to that institution. And so you know you have this incredible audience, and you know that there are people watching what you're doing and actually coming to see what you're doing and being engaged with what you're doing. And it's a very, very different feeling than the kind of isolation of the National Gallery of Canada. They're very different. And one I find really sort of... I know, something that really excites me and drives me, I think, to know that there are that many people behind, you know, what's going on there.
So. One question I have for mm-hmm. you, and mm-hmm. And this varies obviously mm-hmm. between curators, is do you yourself collect art, like a personal collection?
Oh, yeah. You know, I would say to you, I will answer you, I don't know where that phrase comes from. I collect art, but I wouldn't call myself an art collector. In a way, there was a period in time where I wanted to collect art and to be an art collector, as well as be a curator. I thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. I know how to do this. You know what right. I mean? I could do it for myself. But I bought a work, I think it's a major work, by a younger artist called Ron Tirada, who lives in Vancouver. He does any number of kinds of work, so I couldn't say that he's a painter, but I happened to buy a painting by him. And I bought it. I lived in Vancouver before I moved to the National Gallery. I lived there for 3 years. And when I left Vancouver, it's a city I really loved. I wanted to have a kind of souvenir of the city in a way. And this painting is it's a text-based painting, it's a conceptual painting. And it's a kind of conceptual landscape, I would call it that. And, you know, for me, Vancouver, the landscape was so important. So to have this kind of text-based landscaping, it's also very tragic. It's do you know those ads that you see in sort of community papers usually? I saw you at, you know, Denny's. I had this, we said, let's go for a beer. And you said, yes. Well, this is a kind of where a man has met a woman. I think it's a woman, and that's not entirely clear, but met a woman. And, you know, they were going to go on a date, and he took her number, but he never called her, and he wants to get in touch with her. Maybe he lost her number. So it's a kind of, and it's also, it tells you very much where he met her. So you have a picture of a place. I know the place where he met her. So for me, it's this kind of landscape of tragedy in a way. And, you know, maybe Vancouver and BC is, and maybe all places that are really beautiful are landscapes of tragedy because, you know, what we're doing to the earth and with ecology and all that sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? It's, but there are also personal stories and love stories and things like that. But yeah, no, it really, really touched me, and I love Ron's work. I'd put him in shows and things. He's an artist I'd supported, and it made sense for me to have this picture. And I, as well, when you work in my profession, artists will give you things. It's just natural. So you kind of accrue things that way. You can purchase things, but people give you things. And each time that I move now, I notice that I have more. And it's not that I've been actively seeking it out, but in a way it's come to me. And that's, you know, that's a beautiful thing, and it's a lovely thing, but it hasn't been directed in any way other than the things that I've actually purchased. And at a certain point, and after working in a museum, this might sound kind of old-fashioned, but I think the museum is the best possible place for these works to be, in the sense that they will be kept, and they will be, I mean, the things that I have, they'll be looked after properly. I'm not the kind of person who has a, you know, if I could have a kind of own museum on my property that, you know, had environmental conditions and everything, and
exactly.
I'm not in that position, so I always feel the objects make me very nervous in terms of care, and you know, a curator comes. The word curator comes from this kind of medical word, you know, to cure, to look after, to care for, and I sort of feel I have a responsibility to these objects that I can't live up to, and they make me feel kind of guilty. So I you know, owning them sort of should be pleasurable, but somehow there's some pain attached to it. And for example, the painting of Ron Tirada, when I moved to England, it's you know, a biggish painting. It's not a huge painting, but it's, you know, probably 4 feet by 4 feet. And, you know, when you're moving to a country, you don't know exactly where you're going to be living and things, and it's not like, you know, somebody in my salary in England can have a huge, gigantic place. So I just thought it's not a good idea to bring this painting with me. And in fact, I gave it to a friend in Vancouver to look after. He has it up in his house. He'll look after it very well. I know that. I trust him completely. And, you know, something in a way that's mine, but it's no longer with me. I've sort of sent it off in another direction. And, you know, it's odd that way. But there are a few things I brought to London with me, smaller paintings I own. But they were all gifts, three of them. I have two works by Francis Ellis, I did a Mexican artist, and a painting by Peter Doig, who I did a show with.
One of my personal favorites.
I love Peter Doig's work. I'm very attached to the practice. I've followed it for a long time. I've known Peter since 1988, so it's been a close friendship. I did a show with him in Canada, the first show, major show he had in Canada. He had a actually show when he was quite young in Canada, but the first major show he had in Canada, and after that he gave me a painting which, you know, I didn't expect. It just came in a FedEx box in the mail, and there it was. And it's a beautiful painting. It's not a huge painting, but a very beautiful Peter Doig, and I feel really privileged to have it, and that's with me. So I guess those things have meaning, but I haven't actively sought out a lot of work.
Another question that kind of relates back to what we were talking about before with your work at Serpentine, but not necessarily. How important do you think the role of curator is as collaborator versus curator as kind of like a lone cowboy, that, you know, the solo curator? How would you say?
I'm not sure. I'm not quite following your question, so ask it a different way.
How important would you say collaboration is in curation?
Okay, you mean collaborating with an artist?
Yes, or collaborating with other curators as well.
With other curators. I collaborated with other curators. Yes, I have. I just did a show with two other curators in Canada, and that was fine. I learned a lot from doing it, although I forced me to work in ways I wouldn't normally work in. But the exercise was really good. At the end of it, I thought this experience, this show, has been richer, you know, for the fact that I've worked with these three people. Collaboration, you know, when collaboration is good, it makes really interesting things happen. When it isn't good, it, you know, turns into war. So, that was a really strong experience. I guess when you asked about collaboration, I would think more about collaborating with the artists, and that's just the way my brain works. So, at the Serpentine, it's very important to work in a collaborative spirit. It's a small institution. If, you know, the institution wants to go left and I want to go right, and there are more people who want to go left than want to go right, you really have to go left in that case, you know, unless you have a really firm argument to go right. But I find the institution right now a very collaborative, very good place to work, the Serpentine. In terms of collaborating with artists, that's how I first interpreted your question. You know, I think when you're working on shows with artists, you as a curator, your kind of responsibility is to, you know, see their work realized in the best possible way, and in a way that comes through discussion with them. Often, when you're working in a larger museum, I think it's different at the Serpentine, but when you're working in a larger museum, the museum, I think, on a certain level goes to war with the artist, and you're kind of this intermediary where the institution wants one thing from the artist wants something else, you know, from the space of exhibition and the institution, and you're this kind of middle person who's saying, okay, artist, you can have A, B, and C, but we're having difficulties with D. I can't get the museum to agree on D. You know, what would you suggest? And you kind of work through D and figure it out so all parties are happy. So you're kind of a conciliator as well.
Right,
you know what I mean? It's a different job. But collaboration, I guess collaboration is a key thing in contemporary art right now, too. If you start to look at the art being made, there's so much work out there right now that's about, you know, artists working together, different kinds of artists. Ciao, how are you doing? yeah, come and join us. Yeah. No, so there's so much work. Do you know each other?
Nope.
No, okay. There's so much work going on where, you know, artists are collaborating. I'm just trying to think of what's a good example. There's tons of it out there. I don't know. You can look at any number of art projects and just, you know, this is like a key ingredient of work today. But at the same time, you know, I think collaboration has always been part of art practice. I think artists have always turned to other artists to realize things. You know, I can't bring up an example, but I think there are like ballets that took place in the 1920s where, you know, one artist did the set, another artist might have helped compose the music, or, you know, some kind of avant-garde scenario that took a playwright, you know, some actors and some artists coming together. So collaboration has always been part of the art world, but it is particularly important right now, I think. In some ways, I think that it may also be a reaction to, we have this kind of incredible market right now where, you know, contemporary art is probably more expensive than it's ever been. There are more people out there buying it. So you think of a single painting, you know, being bought for this exorbitant price. And so how does an artist, you know, working today, live in this kind of world? Well, I think one of the ways is you know, it's not that you're necessarily reacting against it, but if you start working in teams and you work collaboratively, you diffuse the notion of authorship, who the artist author is, and you create, you know, different kinds of things, and in some cases, things that can't be acquired, things that people can't own. There are still things that, you know, cannot be purchased in this world. I believe there
they're,
are.
They're falling fast.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's a way of also just kind of countering the art world that is or one of the art worlds that's present right now. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah, that was great. Another question that I had for you, obviously, is one danger of curation I've found is that it's very intensive work.
Uh-huh.
And obviously the side effect of that, or the product byproduct of that, is burnout. How do you okay. combat against that or guard against burnout?
Right. I would say, you know, the capacity for burnout isn't any job. It's not particularly in curating. I think that, you know, computer programmers, people who teach in universities, professors, anybody can suffer burnout. And I guess, you know, jobs in the arts traditionally are kind of low paying. You have to, it's kind of labor of love work. You work longer hours than you should. Because you have a passion for the subject, et cetera, et cetera. I guess I'm somebody who, you know, believes in balance. I think balance is very important. I think you can work hard, but I also think you have to play hard, and you have to make sure you get the play time in and the rest time in. I'm somebody who doesn't function very well if I haven't had enough sleep. So right away, you know, getting enough sleep is very, very important.
How much do you sleep?
How much do I sleep? That's a personal question. I don't know how much I sleep. I am somebody who gets a good night's rest. You know, I probably need 8 hours sleep a night to function in the best possible way. So sleep is very important. Rest is very important. You know, exercise, keep eating well, looking after yourself. If you don't, you know, there's very basic things, but if you don't look after yourself properly, you're not gonna do anybody any favors. You know? You have to start with yourself first and move out from there. And yeah, balance is key.
What would you recommend to young curators coming into the field?
Young curators, do you mean people in school or people who have already graduated?
Let's say both.
Well, I think one thing one of my teachers taught me, and I think it's a really basic thing, that when anybody gives you a business card, keep it. Don't throw it away. You never know when you're going to need to talk to that person or phone that person for some kind of information. So keep every single business card, file them away, go into those business card folders, have them there, keep them. They're really important. Something else I would say is meet lots of artists. Go out, do as many studio visits as you can, go to as many openings as you can, meet as many artists as you can. They are your kind of capital, if you like. Your connection to them is your network, and you cannot survive without them. They need you, and you need them. It's a kind of interdependence. So meet as many as you can. I would also say write as much as you can. So one of the things I did very early on was start to write for kind of community newspapers, and from there I graduated to art magazines and things like that. And the minute you start writing and you develop a kind of credible voice, people come to you, and then, you know, they ask for catalog essays and they ask for all kinds of other writing. So, and it's also just a way of, you know, showing your capacity to interpret work, to act as a spokesperson for work. And, you know, if you're doing more experimental writing as well, and it's not necessarily connected to an art practice, but maybe some other aspect of the art world, museum culture, or, you know, maybe it's a kind of rap poem on collecting or something. You know, I think there's many different ways of coming in as a writer. I don't think there's one prescribed way of doing it, but I think writing is really important, developing that side of, because curators are people, you have to be fairly sociable. Even if you're a bit of a hermit, you still have to have a capacity, some kind of capacity for sociability. So you have to be fairly social. You have to have strong connections with artists. You have to have seen as much as you can. So go to every show you can go to. You know, save a few pennies if you can, and, you know, fly off to Paris or fly off to Miami or fly, you know, go and see some shows. Get outside your world as much as possible. Develop as many international contacts as you can. So I think that while, you know, what happens in San Francisco is interesting and something to watch, you should be looking, I think we're all global citizens today, and I think you should be looking at the world and taking the world, you know, looking at the world and taking that as the place that you live in. It's not San Francisco. But you shouldn't ignore San Francisco, of course. Let's see, what else would I say? Just be kind. Be kind to people. I think those are key things, like the things that I went over with you.
Yeah.
They're key. And, you know, start making shows. Like, one of the things, there are a number of people who have worked for me over the years who I think have the capacity to be curators, but they've never actually sort of stepped out of their role as assistant or whatever and gone out. And you sort of wonder, if you are a curator, you kind of have to make shows. You can't not make them. So you'll just start making them. It's something you have to do. It's like being an artist. If you're an artist, you know, you have to make work. You have to make paintings. You have to make sculpture. You have to make interactive performances. You know, no one can stop you. It's sort of coming from you. And I think curators just have to be making shows. You can make shows anywhere. You know, when I lived in Vancouver and had nothing, I made shows in my apartment. You know, you can make a show in your shoe if you want. Shows can happen anywhere. They can happen on the telephone. They can happen in your computer. It can happen anywhere. It's just like a force of your imagination where they take place. So I just say, make exhibitions, get them out there. However, use whatever technology you need. You know, make them in the back of the truck over there. I don't care. Do you know what I mean? Make shows. So that's all I would say.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much, Kitty.
Oh, well, you're absolutely welcome. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I wish you safe travels to Miami, and I hope you have a good trip there.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
This is Neighborhood Public Radio. My name is Zephyr. And the show is called Frank Prattle, 88.9 FM, and I've been live with Kitty Scott, well, recorded live with Kitty Scott from the Serpentine Gallery in London. Thank you.
Thank you.